Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little...
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. You did it again. We're on and not a glitch that I know of. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Tonight, I think, is the start of the basketball tournaments and the NCAA tournament. So I imagine over thousands of shows, we might actually have four listeners. No, that's my audience. Okay, but anyway, thank you for joining us. I think you enjoy the show tonight. We've got a gentleman on that, through the good graces of C-SPAN.org and Book TV, who's one of my favorite judges in the world, I suppose, and I'll keep that a secret if you haven't read the show, Billy. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and that was Johnny Cash taking us on that nice trip across the country. I think one of these days, Audrey, I'm going to try screencasting that. I've been messing around with screencasts, thinking how to use them maybe in some educational settings as opposed to just fun. And I think it would be fun to make a screencast of all the cities that Johnny Cash goes to and try to point to all of them. You might wear yourself out because it's a lot of them. He was going to Dayton, which, you know, the president was it. Was it last night the president was in Dayton? I think it was. No, maybe two nights ago. He was in Dayton, Ohio, and he was at a basketball game with the British prime minister in Dayton. I know Dayton very well. Well, not so well. Now, but I'll mention Dayton a little bit later, University of Dayton, a little bit later in the show. But anyway, thanks, Johnny, for taking us there. Emily, Mike, Lucy, thank you a whole lot. Lucy's not here tonight, by the way. She's a doctoral student, and she has a very special week in her education, so she can't join us. What we do with this little show is we try to discuss events and issues and news and strange developments sometimes and the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And I guess, depending on your sense of humor, some of the things tonight could be humorous. I did get some comments about government food inspectors and our new food plan where we're going to color code the food. That one I'm still trying to do. We're doing it on military bases. Remember, there's the yellow and the red, or the amber and the red and the green food coating, depending on how healthy those foods are for us. I won't go over them again. But what we try to do in this show is look at police courts, corrections, juvenile justice, and some things that are related to it. And we do it U.S. and around the world. All right. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio. As you get right on that network, blogtalkradio.com, first thing up at the top is you can sign up for a show immediately. Isn't that amazing? I think I always say this, but I don't always, but once in a while. I think 20 years ago, you were trying to get a radio show. I mean, what it took to get a radio show that would broadcast worldwide, and that's what you can do with Blog Talk Radio. Any person, any interest group, any organization, they can have their own show and broadcast worldwide in streaming audio, and you can do it virtually every day. I forget how many hours you can broadcast a week. Do you remember, Mike? I think it's 5 that are free. Don't quote me on that either. It's probably more than that. And then if you want prime time and extra hours, it's just a minimal fee. So get your own show, is what I'm saying, and you can, seems like it'd be more fun to have your own show than to Twitter and tweet all the time, or whatever that's called. I know, Mike, you don't either. Mike and I have never Twittered or tweeted. I don't care to ever conjugate that verb either, but tonight's show, here we go. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are new. We've mentioned some odd ones in there. You know, one I felt about not directly related to criminal justice, but related to being armed. I can't believe this story of our Marines at a presentation. They were listening to a presentation in Iraq, or excuse me, Afghanistan, and Panetta was speaking. And because the Afghan soldiers were disarmed in this arena, I don't know why we'd want to do that. Remember, they're the ones that blow people up once in a while? Right. I'm sure some of them do some fine service, but some of them don't. So they disarmed our Marines so that they would be just like the Afghan soldiers, and the Afghan soldiers wouldn't feel like they were singled out. Let me see, whose country is it we're trying to save? I think I remember. Afghanistan. I'm trying to think real hard while we're there, but I'm sure they're various and sundry reason, but I've never heard of a situation like that. And the picture they had on the web, the Drudge Report, was this young Marine. Looked like he was in great shape. He was sitting there and he was paying attention, but he looked a little perplexed. I mean, we're disarming the Marine Corps so that they can be like the Afghan soldiers during this presentation. Frankly, I don't get it. Here's something that's kind of interesting. It just came out yesterday, the verdict, I believe. The Virginia Tech, for the way they handled the mass shootings on their campus 5 years ago, it's faced investigations by state and federal agencies, and they've had trials on courts of public opinion. On Wednesday, the first jury to examine the events of April 16, 2007, ruled. It found the university negligent for not issuing timely warnings of an active threat, and they awarded large sums of money to two families, to two daughters were killed. Terrible that they were killed. But remember the story, the Romanian professor who taught there, and he put himself up against the door and took the bullets and saved lives of people. I mean, it's awful, but now they're getting, they decided to sue separately as opposed to some joint type of suit, but this Su-Hui Cho, he burst into classrooms in Norris Hall and shot them along with 28 other students, of 30, I guess, total. Well, that didn't count the professor, but he was shot and killed also. But anyway, what a hero he was to try to save the lives of those students. But you'd expect that of Romanian professors, believe me. The ones I know, that's the way they would act. So. And I think Virginia Tech said they weren't ready to send this message. I'm not going to go into the real super details about it, but it was an $11 million settlement with the university and state before anybody sued. And the settlement granted each family $100,000 in additional compensation for medical. That's the Virginia law somehow, the $100,000 max. So we'll be hearing more about this one. Remember how much fun you have at the TSA at the airport? Well, guess what? Orlando, Sanford International Airport, they're going to opt out. You actually have the right to do that. You have to do it under the supervision of the TSA, but you can get rid of the TSA agents in the United States at your airport. I can't quote. You remember, Mike, I think it's, or Lucy, you might have talked about it, but I think it's only, there's 30-some airports or something in the United States that have their own private security or their own security. Now, it has to meet the standards of the TSA, but you're getting rid of TSA. So
I guess some of the folks feel we've had so many incidents with these TSA agents and improper abusive searches and that type of thing that they're going to do. I haven't seen it yet, but if you turn 75, you're not going to get the same kind of treatment anymore as everybody else gets. We've had so many stories of, you know, 85-year-old women and men and being, you know, well, being whatever you can imagine. But anyway, that's easy. You know, this drone business is taking off now. They're actually saying if you're reading the future, I'm not going to go into this in much depth because I want to get to our show content tonight. But the 21-year-old people can fly these planes. And I bought one at Radio Shack and it didn't work. So I took it back, and that's the first time that I can ever recall I ever took anything back to Radio Shack, having been one of their best customers in the 1990s and late 1980s. But anyway, they're saying people, there's going to be all kinds of planes within the next 10 years up in the air, from little tiny drones the size of model airplanes to all kinds. And guess what they're going to be doing? They're going to be polishing the outsides of buildings. They'll be on autopilots. They'll be doing all kinds of workforce that takes care that needs to be done up in the air. Maybe you can instead of sending somebody a tweet, you can send them a little motorized drone that can land on their window like a bird, like a carrier pigeon. But it says that the sky is just going to be filled with these things. And, of course, we're moving farther and farther away from manned aircraft. They're seeing a lot of our defense in the United States when planes have to go up, it won't be real people on the planes. And anyway, the director of the Humans and Automation Lab at MIT, Missy Cummings, she says in 15 years, you could look up in the sky and see UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, doing window washing and building inspections. You could all see your jealous ex-husband or wife following their significant other around. For good or bad, we're on the cusp of this era, she says. But isn't that something? I mean, MIT is a great school, and they're usually pretty good at forecasting things, but that is really weird. This is one I thought, I hesitate to even mention his name, but his name's in the paper, and he's quoted. But we're always talking about, excuse me, gun safety. Excuse me. With campus firearms laws in a flux, you know, we've got states that allow, I think there's 11 campuses in the United States right now where you can have a student with a concealed carry license can carry the gun on campus. In fact, we just got in a thing over there about Oregon. The Oregon court, so the Oregon state tried to take that right away from Oregonians who had CCW licenses on campus, and the federal court said they couldn't do that. But anyway, this is the chief of police, and it's the kind of thing that might happen to anybody, but on Monday it happened to Michael Martinson, chief of police at Wright State University. Martinson needed to use the campus toilet, according to the Daily News, but the weight of his service revolver threatened to push his trousers and belt into a puddle on the floor. He solved the problem by wedging the gun between the plumbing. Unfortunately, he was in a hurry. He had to go to a meeting. He got up and he took off, and he left the gun behind. And then an alert student came in later and spotted the gun and turned the thing in. And he was very humble about all this and embarrassed to what degree we can even imagine. But he says, "I lost focus for a minute," says Chief Martinson. "So I humiliated myself in front of the police officers. As punishment, he ordered himself to undergo 4 hours of firearm safety class." Probably not a bad idea, actually. As states like Colorado and Oregon debate the constitutionality of banning guns on campus, campus planners would be wise to consider where people should stash their weapons when nature calls. Yeah, they could have little lockers or something. I guess you could probably do that. But I don't think you're going to see the guns on campus and go much farther than it has right now. Okay, we have a joke. Lucy's going to allow me to do the blonde joke tonight. Thank you very much, Lucy, because it's something to do with policing, and she knows at one time I had a few things to do with policing over the years. So here's the joke, and it's one of the really quick ones, and it says, are you ready, Mike? Why do blondes have trouble? calling 911. Anybody know the answer to that? The answer is they have trouble finding 11 on their cell phones. What do you think? Well, thank you very much. I looked that one up myself, actually. The Ohio Coalition Against Firearms, since we're going to be talking a little bit about guns tonight, we already have, they have a public service announcement that all of us should hear in order to take precaution.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Yes, it is a deadly idea. I don't even know if we have a bill before our legislature about carrying guns on campus. I don't think we do. Anyway, as I said, I don't think that's going to fly very far here in the U.S. We have a green tip for tonight, and this one is really great. You know, you're using lights all over your house, aren't you? I'm not even going to read this, but it came from Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And here's what Esma Floyd says on this tip. You know, if you think about it, you got sunshine coming into your house all over the place, right? I mean, you got sunshine here, you got sunshine there, and I'll bet you haven't arranged your furniture in such a way that you'll always have the maximum light wherever you're eating. It'll be sunlight wherever you're sitting to read, whether you're sitting up and sleeping somewhere and you need some light. The light will always shine in if you arrange your furniture properly. So I want you to take a little inventory tomorrow, and you have time this weekend, and move your furniture around to where you get the most sunlight. Now, I have heard of people moving their furniture around to get out of the sunlight, but that's not the purpose here. You can turn off your lights, and who knows how much money and energy you could save by just putting the chairs and the furniture and the tables in the proper place. What do you think? I love that tip. I'm gonna think about doing that myself in my office. My office is weird. I appreciate it. That was a great point. All right, what we're going to do tonight is have a very special guest, and I think you're going to enjoy this presentation. It takes a couple minutes for me to set this up, but this is in the afterwards section of Book TV. So Book TV brings us another guest, and this is Judge Andrew Napolitano. And if you ever watch the Fox Business Network or that type of thing, he is a very entertaining libertarian commentator, and he debates politics and history and what he considers to be the unconstitutional behavior of both the Bush administration and the Obama administration with consumer advocate and four-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader. You haven't heard from Ralph Nader in a while, but you watch C-SPAN a lot. But Ralph is a very interesting thing. Napolitano was a New Jersey judge from 1987 to 1995, 8 years. He was the youngest life-tenured judge in the state's history, in the state of New Jersey. He's currently senator, or senior judicial analyst for the Fox News Network, and the fill-in host on Glenn Beck's show, and the host of Fox Business's network Freedom show called Freedom Watch. So I think you'll enjoy the judge. He's a very interesting commentator, and certainly his bulbs are lighted to the maximum, and I think you'll see that in this discussion. So here we go with Judge Andrew Napolitano.
Coming up next, Book TV presents Afterwards, an hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, author and judicial analyst Andrew Napolitano discusses his new book, Lies the Government Told You. In it, the former New Jersey judge argues that government officials have consistently violated the Constitution for years, with little protest from the public. He goes on to say that individual freedom is regularly violated by the state, and that most Americans are too willing to look the other way. He debates his perspective with consumer advocate and three-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader.
Lies the Government Told You, Myth, Power, and Deception in American History by Andrew P. Napolitano. And Mr. Napolitano is here to have a discussion which I think to the audience is likely never to forget. This is a very powerful book. In a world of self-censorship, Mr. Napolitano does not self-censure. He graduated from Princeton University in 1972, Notre Dame Law School in 1975. And what have you been doing briefly since then?
Admiring your work, right? It's a pleasure to be here with
you.
Absolutely. You and I met first when I was an undergraduate. You were a hero then, and you're a hero now. We're both graduates of the same wonderful educational institution. I practiced law for about 10 years in New Jersey, and then I was appointed to the bench by Governor Tom Kaine. This is a trial court of general jurisdiction, so everything from jaywalking to serious crime, everything from a slip and fall in a supermarket to serious economic causes of action. It's a full-time judgeship. You're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate for 7 years. He's reappointed and reconfirmed before the end of the 7, you have it for life. I was given my lifetime appointment by Governor Christine Todd Whitman. After about 8 years, I got a little bored and decided there were other things I wanted to do, and I returned to private practice. That was unusual because people usually don't leave life-tenured judgeships. After just a couple of weeks in private practice, I was approached by the then president of CNBC, who said, you know, we're about to come to this trial in California. It's a little crazy. The judge is a little off the wall. I thought maybe I'll put an ex-judge on the air, a second-guest trial judge in this case. You ever heard of him? His name is Lance Ito. So I covered for CNBC the O.J. Simpson trial for 4 or 5 days a week for 13 months, at the end of which we all know the outcome. At that time, MSNBC was formed. The president of CNBC, who had engaged me, founded Fox. That was Roger Ailes.
Mm-hmm.
And so Roger was kind enough to bring many of us who had worked for him at CNBC over to Fox, so I was there almost at the very beginning. I was practicing law while doing all this. I've been at Fox since 1998, full-time since 2001.
And now you're starting a new program, a libertarian program, it's called in the New York Times.
I am.
On the weekend.
I am. It's called Freedom Watch. We tape it on Thursday mornings. It runs 4 times on weekends. And it is dedicated to the proposition that the individual has certain natural rights, which the government can't take away, absent a jury trial for violating somebody else's natural rights. It's dedicated to the belief that the free market is indispensable to human prosperity, to the belief that the people have the right to have a government that stays within the confines of the Constitution, and much of what the government does is outside those confines. I'm a night watchman.
Yeah.
My job is to watch the government and report when it takes freedom and property.
All right, now let's get into this book. This is your fifth book on the Constitution you've written. You're very serious on it being safeguarded and applied. And I want to read exactly how you define lies, because this is very important. You're not just talking about myths. You're not talking about false statements. You're talking about lies. And in your book, you define it this way, quote, "Truth is identity between intellect and reality. A lie is a knowing and intentional violation of the truth. The difference between the two often depends on whether one is in the governing class or the governed class." Now, here's how you apply it, starting early in American history. And this is the kind of party line that really is taught to millions of school children. And you don't mince words. Here's what you say. Quote, "Would Americans have reelected Franklin Delano Roosevelt had they known that he caused the attack on Pearl Harbor? Would voters have chosen Lyndon Baines Johnson, the supposed peace candidate in 1964, had they known he was secretly planning to ramp up the Vietnam War? Would George W. Bush have been reelected in 2004 if we knew he was illegally spying on us, concocting evidence for war, torturing people, and lying about it," end quote. Now, this shows you you're nonpartisan. You've got Democrat, Republican. And what you do in the book is basically describe the lies and give your evidence, and then you have footnotes throughout the book. So this is not like an offhand assertion. And So I want to go through a number of these lies. And the first one is every vote counts. Lie four, every vote counts. And you really go after Bush versus Gore and other things. So just explain why you think the statement, every vote counts, which is ingrained in our political consciousness, is a lie.
The Bush versus Gore case was a violation of federalism. It was the federal court telling a state court system how to count its votes. It was an artificial endpoint. The Supreme Court said you can count the votes, but you've got to stop in an hour and a half. And they came down at 10:30 at night. The deadline was midnight. It was a massive federal intrusion into an area reserved under the Constitution for the states. So it prevented every vote from counting. And it was a decision made by justices, some of whom are friends of mine, who had a political predilection in the direction that they want to go on both sides of it. They should have had nothing to do with it. The outcome should have been abided by the political machinery in Florida, whether that was the legislature or the Florida Supreme Court. But for the Supreme Court of the U.S. to jump in and on a party line vote say the end is now here assaults the concept of representative democracy.
What should they have done?
Nothing.
And
decisions should have been made by the highest authorities in Florida, whether that was the legislature retroactively changing the law, as it was attempting to do, by saying, we're going to decide where the electoral votes go, or whether it was the Supreme Court of Florida saying to the legislature, you can't do that, be patient. When they finish the recount, they'll tell us who won. But it was a Florida decision. The basis for the decision was equal protection. The basis for the decision was hanging chads count in some parts of Florida, and they don't count in others. Equal protection has never been used by a federal court to regulate the manner in which votes have been counted. It was never intended to regulate that part of governmental behavior.
So this is really a political decision.
Absolutely.
5-4.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the public did not get, probably, because we don't really even know what happened in Florida. There were a couple of subsequent recounts. We don't even know if the public got the person they voted for. We know they got the person who received millions of fewer popular votes, but through our constitutional system, succeeded in getting, and the Supreme Court's intervention, succeeded in getting a majority of electors.
So what you're saying is Gore got 500,000 more votes than Bush, but the Electoral College threw it into Florida.
That's the history.
Yeah. I know you use other cases to make the point, and you criticize the Chief Justice Rogers, Roberts, when he was up for the Senate for confirmation. He said judges are like umpires. They call balls and they call strikes.
You know, that was a great soundbite, and it probably deflected some criticism of him for people who feared he would be an activist, whichever way you want to go, and however you define activist, there's some activism that I think you and I agree is necessary when it's protecting the Constitution. And so it was a soundbite that sounded nice, but judges are not umpires. Judges are there because of their value set, their understanding of the law, the way they look at the Constitution. Look at this debate that went on the other day between Justice Souter and Justice Scalia. Is the Constitution a living document intended to be adapted to present-day needs, or should it be interpreted today the way we believe the framers who wrote it, wanted it to have been interpreted when they wrote it? These are profound issues, and they are affected by what judges think. A judge you and I admire, Benjamin Nathan Cardozo, once said, justice is determined by the personality of the judges. That sounds outrageous, but it's true. They're human beings. They bring their value set to the courtroom, and no one can deny that.
Which a lot of senators deny constantly. And,
yes.
Cardozo was a brilliant jurist, member of the Supreme Court, wrote this great book we all read in law school, The Nature of the Judicial Process.
Right.
But they still, a lot of senators still think it's just an automatic process, you know, just like umpires.
Well, if that were the case, then we could have an Supreme Court. We wouldn't need the human factor in there.
And why do they differ so much then?
Precisely. Right. There are justices who believe that the Constitution means what it says and guarantees are guaranteed. There are others that say, well, there's wiggle room for everything.
Yeah. Okay. Line number 7, your body is your temple. And you go into issues of the war on drugs and what you call the food police. You criticize Roe versus Wade, but you don't give your opinion on abortion. in that area. I didn't see it in the book. What's your stand on that?
Ralph, I am a pre-Vatican II.
Yeah.
So I am absolutely opposed to abortion under all circumstances. This is a philosophical judgment.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot determine medically precisely when life begins. I give the benefit of the doubt at the beginning. So this book is not about my philosophy of when life begins,
yeah,
but I am clearly on record as being in the pro-life camp, forcefully and vehemently in the pro-life camp. Putting that mm-hmm. aside, there is no right to an abortion under the Constitution. There's a right to privacy, but there's not a right to commit a crime under the right to privacy.
So what's the role of the government with women's reproductive rights?
In my opinion, the fetus is a separate individual, and that individual has rights and can command the protection of the government just as you and I. And for that reason, there could be no abortion after due process, which would be inconceivable to demonstrate that the fetus is somehow culpable of being executed.
Well, this, you know, the libertarian view usually is that the government shouldn't have a right to tell a woman either to have a child or not to have a child.
You are correct. And I part ways with a lot of my sisters and brothers who are libertarians on that issue. There is a growing pro-life group among libertarians, but many true North libertarians, of which I am one, do not recognize the fetus as a independent being. They have the obligation of the government to keep hands off. Most of this chapter basically says in a society where a woman can execute the baby in the womb, how could a person not put whatever chemical they want into their body as long as by doing that no one else does?
Well, the interesting thing about this is that you're pretty consistent, according to what most people think libertarianism is, when it comes to the war on drugs. Marijuana, heroin, cocaine, what would you do?
None of the government says a person has the freedom of choice. They have the right to be wrong. They have the right to impair their body. They have the right to utilize whatever substance they want in the privacy of their home as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. If it hurts a child in the home because a parent is taking it, the government can intercede. If someone gets behind a piece of heavy machinery, like a train or a plane or a car, under the influence of drugs, it's the same thing as driving under the influence of alcohol. It's the government's job to protect innocents from persons in that situation. But if a person utilizes recreational drugs exclusively in their own home, and no one is harmed thereby, it is their choice, and it is none of the government's business. But if I own my own body, I can decide what to put in that body. The government can't make that decision for me.
What if the woman has the fetus?
That could impair the fetus. And as you know, there are cases of women, public opinions, where women have taken recreational drugs, and it has affected the fetus. Or the state has argued it has affected the fetus, and the woman, post-birth of the child, has the process. I'm not in favor of police telling us what to do with their bodies. I'm not in favor of the mayor of New York saying there's too much salt on restaurant tables. This nanny state will lead to the loss of all freedom. But if the fetus is a separate human being, and I believe it is, then that human being is the most helpless in the world, totally dependent upon the mother in whose womb she or he resides, and can command the protection of the fetus.
Let's take your phrase, food police. 7,000 Americans died because of contaminated food. And a lot of it is contaminated seafood. Some of it is coming in from China, for example, contaminated. You really, when you go to a restaurant, you don't have the senses to detect a lot of this.
Right.
You can't taste, smell, or see botulism, for example. What role would you have for the government in regulating food for safety?
I would have no role in the government for regulating food for safety because the government is the most inefficient regulator of private behavior we have. It is heavy-handed, it is thoughtless, it breaks its own laws, it is inefficient, and it adds to the cost of everything.
We'll get to that abstraction in a moment. The key is 7,000 die, 70,000 are sick, and many, many thousands of those are hospitalized.
Because,
how do you deal with that?
Because we rely on the government to do what it can't do.
Well, who can do it?
Well, there should be some private enterprise. There should be some entity, perhaps paid by the insurance companies that insure the restaurants and don't want people to get sick because they'd be on the hook if somebody sued.
Why aren't they doing that now?
Because they rely on the government. When you and I go into a restaurant, as we may very well do, when this wonderful interview is over, we don't think twice about the cheeseburger we're about to eat because we assume that some bureaucrat, barely educated, ignorant of the law, nevertheless has walked in the kitchen and performed some kind of a test of the food. That doesn't work.
Well, actually, it has worked. Food has been recalled, food has been condemned, lives have been saved.
Well, there's a moral obligation from
yes.
the preparer of the food
yes.
and the distributor of the food, not to put something contaminated into the food chain, so to speak.
Well, how about the right to sue? If you're contaminated, you get sick. Sue the food company or the rest.
Absolutely.
You don't believe in tort, restricting tort law?
Absolutely. I am against the mantra of tort reformers, because tort has resulted in an uplifting of human society. You remember a famous New Jersey Supreme Court case, Hennington versus Bloomfield
yeah.
Motors.
Yeah.
Every law student in the United States studies it. As a result of that case, the automobile manufacturer started making brakes more savory because Mrs. Hennington was severely injured by a car sold by Bloomfield Motors at a time when there was no warranty of merchantability for the brakes. How did that happen? Because a courageous lawyer brought a lawsuit in a court system that has rejected all those. That's just what they said.
So that's contrary. Your position against so-called tort reform, which I call tort deform, you take away people's rights,
right.
is quite contrary to the dogma of a lot of Republicans.
It is.
Yeah.
It's against the dogma of conservative Republicans, but it's not against the dogma of those of us who believe the individual is greater than the state and that our rights are natural and one of the legitimate functions of the government, even to this true North libertarian, is to provide a forum to seek the redress of your business, which we call the court.
As a matter of fact, the studies show that over 90% of wrongful entry never reaches a lawyer. You know, they don't even get to the court. You know, so what do you think of this mantra that tries to justify taking away people's access to court by saying we're a litigious society? Where's the evidence for that?
I think a lot of my friends and colleagues will recoil at the following state. I think that because a lot of trial lawyers tend to be liberal Democrats, I don't know why, the conservative Republicans resist them. Wait until one of them is injured and they need a trial lawyer to go after the big business or even the small shop owner that had a banana peel on his floor and caused that issue. The right to sue is one of the great protected natural rights going back to the Magna Carta. The government should not interfere with that.
You're getting an argument from me on that. Next lie, this is getting into more controversial depths here. The next lie I want to discuss with you is lie 12, which says, quote, everyone is innocent until proved guilty, end quote. You say that's the lie. Why?
Because the government has enacted legislation which has so hampered defendants. It has so treated them as if they were guilty before proof. It has made it so difficult, before trial, it has made it so difficult for them to defend themselves that the government acts as if a person is guilty merely on the basis of an accusation or an allegation. The government breaks its own laws when it leaves grand jury material in order to affect the jury pool, the people from whom the jury will come, so that they will conclude that this person must be guilty. Look at all the stuff that's in the newspapers about them. The government seizes assets of individuals merely because they've been indicted, so they don't have the resources with which to hire counsel to defend themselves. The government persuades judges that this guy has a passport, therefore he might flee. You can't let him be free. He has to actually prepare for his trial in a cell with 15 other people, 14 of whom might want to kill him, and in which there's no peace of mind or opportunity to deal with his client, which violates other ones. The seizure of property, post-indictment and pre-conviction, is one of the great modern travesties of our criminal justice system, because the standard of proof for seizure is less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Prosecutors have persuaded judges, you know, we're probably going to win this case. Let's take this money now so he can get this. And he has to have a public defender instead of Ralph Nader or some really great lawyer to defend him.
What about the more serious violations of habeas corpus? You know, after 9/11, Bush rounded up thousands of Americans, many of them Muslim Americans, Arab Americans. And they were thrown in jail without charges. They didn't have lawyers. Some of them were pretty mistreated in New York City. And they were all released eventually.
Correct.
What is that what you mean also about throwing people in jail without charges, violating habeas corpus?
That is so obviously a violation of the natural law, the natural right to be brought before a neutral arbiter within moments of the government taking your freedom away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution. Constitution itself, as the Supreme Court in the Boumediene case pretty much said, wherever the government goes, the Constitution goes with it, and wherever the Constitution goes are the rights that the Constitution has to guarantee, and habeas corpus cannot be suspended by the president ever. It can only be suspended by the Congress in times of rebellion, which In Ray Milligan says, being rebellion of such magnitude, the judges can't get into their courthouses. That has not happened in American history. So what President Bush did with the suspension of habeas corpus, with the whole concept of what's up, right, with the whole idea that he could avoid and evade federal laws, treaties, federal judges, and the Constitution, was blatantly unconstitutional, and in some cases,
what's the sanction for President Bush?
Fortunately, there has been no sanction except what history will say about them.
What should be the sanction?
They should have been indicted. They absolutely should have been indicted for torturing, for spying, for arresting without warrant. I'd like to say they should be indicted for lying. Believe it or not, unless they're under oath, lying is not a crime.
Yeah.
It's not an indictable crime. It's a moral crime.
So you think George W. Bush should, even though they've left office, they haven't escaped the criminal laws, they should be indicted, prosecuted?
The evidence in this book and in others, our colleague, the great Vincent Bugliosi, has amassed an incredible amount of evidence. The purpose of this book was not to amass that evidence, but I do discuss it, is overwhelming when you compare it to the level of evidence required for a normal indictment, that George W. Bush, as president, and Dick Cheney, as vice president, participated in criminal conspiracies to violate the federal law and the guaranteed civil liberties of hundreds, maybe thousands of human beings.
Is Obama still supervising torture?
As far as I know, yes. As far as I know, people are still undergoing rendition. We still have some of these black prisons, they call them. I don't know why that phrase is, but the intelligence community refers to it because they like to deny that it exists, like a black hole. And we still have people in Guantanamo Bay who are being kept without charge, without trial, and the president still claims the power to lock people up and throw away the key. Recently, this president claimed the power through his then director of national intelligence, Admiral Blair, who has since resigned, though I'm not sure he's left office yet, to kill Americans on foreign soil if the president thinks that they are engaged in acts of terrorism. That would be murder.
In other words, the president, contrary to our separation of powers, the president becomes the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, and the executioner.
In his own mind, yes. And what torments me, Ralph, is that there was no outrage when Admiral Blair said that. I don't know if President Bush did that, and I don't hold water for President Bush, but if he had said that, or if Admiral Hayes, President Bush's director of national security, had said that while President Bush was in office, our friends in the media would have gone over the top about it, and rightly so. Why did they not do so when President Obama's director of national security said that? Why do we believe that as we're sitting in a comfortable studio in Washington, D.C., somebody not far from here is pressing a button on a computer which dispatches a plastic drone to somewhere in Pakistan to kill an American? If the government believes an American committed a crime, arrest him, indict him, and follow due process. That's what the Constitution says.
Well, lie number 15 is we don't torture, which we've been talking about. And at the beginning, you say, on June 26, 2003, President George W. Bush asserted, quote, the United States is committed to a worldwide elimination of torture, and we're leading this fight by example, end quote. You continue, no surprise here, President Bush lied. The United States of America is not committed to the worldwide elimination of torture. Rather, under Bush, it supported, facilitated, and directly engaged in torture. The United States has tortured people and will continue to torture so long as Americans overlook and excuse the crimes committed by our government and as long as Americans accept government deception on torture. Now, you say that torture violates U.S. law, like the War Crimes Act of 1996,
yes.
Clinton. It violates the U.S. Army Manual. It violates the U.S. Constitution. It violates the Geneva Convention. Where are the 1 million lawyers in this country, only a tiny number of which, including you, have spoken up? Aren't they supposed to be the sentinels for the rule of law,
they
for
are.
Probable cause,
they,
for due process?
They are. Yes.
How do you explain that?
I don't understand the reticence of lawyers to stand up for the rights of the innocent unless it's, forgive me for saying this, racial, because the innocents all have to be young males are, for the most part, in their 20s with dark skin. I hope that that's not the case, but it's the only rational conclusion that one can come to. Lawyers should be shouting from the rooftops. They should be filing lawsuit after lawsuit. They should be seeking indictment after indictment. If there's any line that can be drawn in the sand, it is that we don't torture. I believe it doesn't work. There's a lot of evidence in there that it doesn't work. Even if it does work, it is the most contrary thing to our values and our standards one could imagine. We simply don't do it. And this, I argue, that George Bush made arguments that he didn't do it, but in fact did. And I quote a Deputy Assistant to Secretary of Defense, Susan Crawford, who simply said, we tortured. We did, no matter what the president said.
That's right. It's right.
The evidence is overwhelming. Now Federal Judge Bybee, when he was Assistant Attorney General Bybee, wrote a horrific memorandum to the president telling him what he could have got away with and what he couldn't. In the memorandum itself, he contradicts himself in the sense that these techniques are a near occasion of death, which is one of the definitions of an act of torture.
Would you prosecute him? Would you prosecute John Yoo, who was his collaborator in the memos, the notorious memos justifying these war crimes?
Without question. Unfortunately, the Justice Department, the present Justice Department, President Obama's Justice Department, has just issued some sort of a whitewash that these guys are just lawyers giving advice. There's a certain point beyond which a lawyer knows she or he cannot go with giving advice, especially when the entity to which you're giving advice has all the power and might of the President of the United States. They advised him to commit crime. That advice is criminal.
And you say in your book, Mr. President and Attorney General Holder, what are you waiting for? And you're referring to President Obama.
And I would ask him that if I had the opportunity. A lawyer who taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago,
yeah.
He knows these things.
You know, Michael Greco was head of the American Bar Association around 2005, and he and other lawyers, some of them who were in the National Security Agency before they became private lawyers, sent three white papers to Bush asserting that in one area after another he's violating the Constitution. And that was the only really strong stand in writing by the American Bar Association, which has 400,000 members. What would you do to kickstart the American Bar Association and 1 million lawyers who are supposed to be officers of the court?
Well, I'm not a member of the American Bar Association, but these people should have filed lawsuits which require answers, which get before a federal judge, and which gives you tools, which we call discovery tools. They allow you to find out what the defendant was doing and what the defendant was thinking. If the defendant is the president of the United States, the court wants to say, wait till he or she leaves office before we do this interrogation, then so be it. That time would be ripe and the right would be now. My hat is off to Mr. Greco and what those folks did, but they barely scratched the surface of what they should have done and of what the tools the law has given them.
Because you know, really, the American people cannot rely, with a few exceptions, on a million American attorneys to uphold constitutional rights, civil liberties and civil rights, due process and probable cause, except in this narrow area, thanks to African American mobilization back Martin Luther King time, where they do have legal staff and they do bring suit. But in the area of foreign policy, in the area of the so-called war on terror, in all these areas you discuss in your book, they're AWOL.
One of my prior books is called Judge Scott's Revenge, A Legal History of Race and Treatment of America. And every time I take a train past Baltimore, I think of the childhood stories of Justice Thurgood Marshall. Where is the Thurgood Marshall of today to challenge the government? He almost single-handedly overthrew Jim Crow because he walked into a courtroom with a white judge and a white jury and said, this is wrong and it's got to stop. That should happen today. There should be a Thurgood Marshall for civil liberties against war crimes out there today, and I want to meet that person.
Peterson, it's often said the great advances in American jurisprudence do not start with judges, juries. They start with the advocate, lawyer, who brings the case.
Yes. And you and I were both trained that way. I taught law school for 11 years. The young people are still trained that way.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're coming back, and we're going
to
take a break, and we're coming back, and I'm going to discuss lie number 14, which is really dynamite, quoting Franklin Delano Roosevelt, quote, your boys are not going to be sent to foreign war. We'll be back.
Afterwards and several other C-SPAN programs are available for download as podcasts. More with Andrew Napolitano and Ralph Nader in a moment.
We've got three C-SPAN books for you: Abraham Lincoln, The Supreme Court, and Who's Buried in Grant's Tomb, each with a unique contemporary perspective and perhaps something new to you about Lincoln, the nation's highest court, and the great sites and lives of America's presidents. To order, go to cspan.org/book.
Afterwards, with Andrew Napolitano and Ralph Nader, continues.
We're back with Mr. Napolitano. I want to discuss lie number 14. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars, where you basically describe how the Constitution has been so flouted. I mean, the declaration of war doesn't really exist. It's been neutered by an abdication by Congress. Bruce Fine has written a lot about this, right? And he thinks that Congress has turned itself into an ink blot, and it is abdicating its constitutional duties and responsibilities to the White House, which centralizes power in the White House. Could you explain lie number 14?
I'm a great admirer of Bruce Fine's work, and he has pointed out in an academic and intellectual way the abdication of the Congress of its constitutional role of declaring war. The Congress did a couple of things. In reaction to some of the things President Nixon did, it enacted the War Powers Act, which of course he vetoed, and then his veto was overridden. They thought they were enacting the War Powers Act in order to restrain the president, like a lot of legislation, as the unintended consequence of unleashing the president. So under the federal law, the president of the United States could fight any war he wants for 180 days, mobilize all the human beings he wants and all the material he wants, and doesn't need the consent of anybody. That's a violation of the Constitution. 180-day war is a war, no matter what you call it. The Constitution says only the president can declare war. After 9/11, President Bush did not ask for a declaration of war. He asked for something amorphous called the Authorization to Use Military Force, by its initials, AUMF. And the Authorization to Use Military Force basically says that President Bush and his successors go after anybody you want in the war on terror, use any means at your disposal. Well, that's an open-ended war. There's nobody to surrender. There's no target identified. Which I believe that FDR maneuvered the Japanese into attacking and killing innocent American sailors and soldiers on December 7, 1941. But as a result of that, you got a declaration of war against three countries. And when those countries surrendered, he lost his war-making powers. President Bush never lost the powers given him by the Congress under the AUMF. President Obama inherited them, and as long as that monstrosity is on the books, every one of their successors will have this absolute power to wage any war they want, anywhere they want. That's not what the framers intended. That's not what the Constitution says.
And you'll apply that to the Vietnam War, Korean War, and the Spanish War.
I will certainly do that. The Vietnam War was particularly egregious, as we know. And I was on the Princeton campus when you came to the campus to speak against the Vietnam War, and I was wearing a T-shirt that said Bomb Hanoi, and I still came up and shook hands with you because my views were different at the time. But we now know that Lyndon Johnson and his staff, and perhaps some of the military folks around here, lied about, made up the Gulf of Tonkin in order to get not a declaration of war, but a similar Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Go ahead, Mr. President, destroy North Vietnam because they tried to bomb a ship, which we would later learn throughout history wasn't even there when it was supposedly bombed.
And Korea, which is considered a UN-approved police action, was that enough?
No, that was not enough because the Constitution means what it says, Ralph. And when presidents, even with popular support, even in times of emergency, think that they can twist and torture and maneuver their way around the Constitution, that begins a slippery slope, and it is a precedent for other presidents to do the same thing. The most powerful weapon that the president has, after the power to prosecute somebody, is the power to wage war. The courts will interfere with a prosecution. The courts will never interfere with a war. Why? War is the health of the state. War lets the state regulate human behavior. War lets people surrender their liberties because they think they'll be kept safe. War lets the government raise taxes. And when the war is over, do the taxes go down? Do the liberties come American War in here, but we do know from history that the Spanish-American War was concocted by President McKinley because wartime presidents are powerful presidents, and the state is treated with grandiosity during the time.
Again, the ship supposedly blew up in Havana.
You know, there's a lot of evidence that that ship was blown up by our own people. The Lusitania at World War One. Woodrow Wilson would not let warnings go out to Americans. Don't go on that ship because it's going to go through waters where there are German U-boats. The British begged him not to let Americans get on that ship. He turned a deaf ear because he wanted us in the war. We fought that war for 14 months and 100,000 dead Americans.
You made a strong point of after every war, power is centralized, especially into the White House. Civil liberties are compromised. Fear is spread. In fact, you said the base of fear by the people. So it isn't like we're idiosyncratic here in the United States. My reading of history is all societies and all governments lie to themselves.
Yes.
That's the way they have cohesion. That's the way they can mobilize and control people. That's the way they can live with their misdeeds, okay? So it's hard to find a single government in the world that hasn't got a rationalization for the violence it inflicts on other people.
So think about it. It's the same generation, in some cases the same human beings who wrote, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech," also wrote the Alien and Sedition Act, which made it a felony to put the government into disrepair by the use of your words. How could the same people do that? There's a lust, with libido dominante, the lust to dominate. And this was...
Well, as you can see, both of these gentlemen are very excited about living within the rule of law and keeping excessive government out of our lives and the work of our states within the nation. Anyway, it would be good to read the judge's book. There's another book I'd like to recommend if you haven't seen it. And some of these stores are actually selling this book for a very low price. It's called The Portable Patriot. And this book, it's from the beginning of the end, from the very beginning of the Mayflower Compact speech, right on through all the important documents that you know of in terms of the Constitution and things like that, but all kinds of other speeches by ministers, servants, politicians, soldiers, etc., statements by a woman, the second article in the whole book is about a woman who was captured by the Indians way back in the 1600s. I mean, it's an incredible little book. I paid $6.97 for it on sale in a bookstore. So it's called The Portable Patriot by Joel Miller and Kristen Parrish, P-A-R-R-I-S-H. So I'd highly recommend the thing. And in fact, the cover is very neat. The way they've done the cover of the book, you really appreciate it. Anyway, that's it for tonight. We'll have Vera Lim sign us off.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know where.